Welcome to another episode of Repeak. We are a show about remakes, reboots, and revivals because nothing is original anymore. My name is Diana Olympia.
And I'm Stephanie Kim. Today, we're talking to All the Boys I've Loved Before, Always and Forever, the finale to the To All the Boys trilogy on Netflix, based on the books by Jenny Han, To All the Boys I've Loved Before, P.S. I Still Love You, and Always and Forever, Lara Jean. But first, news!
So we are recording this a couple days before this episode is dropping. But by the time you hear this, To All the Boys I've Loved Before, Always and Forever will be out on Netflix, as well as the 1997 Rodgers and Hammerstein Cinderella that we have all been clamoring for collectively,
which
Steffi and I did a podcast on, I believe, last November. So it's actually out right now. If you're listening to this, it's on Disney Plus. Very excited for all of you to rewatch it. No word on the soundtrack, which I've been like replying to tweets of people who have been making this announcement saying like, but hey, what about the soundtrack? And no confirmations yet, because I can guarantee by the time you finish watching this, or even while you're watching the movie, you will be wanting to listen to the songs. So we'll see about that. But very exciting turn of events. It is our second installment of manifesting things into the world. The first one, of course, was the Taylor Swift Evermore, Forevermore indie double album. So you're welcome. We just want to say happy double drop day to everybody. Enjoy. Go watch both of these things today immediately or this weekend, which is Valentine's Day weekend. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody.
Happy Valentine's Day.
The other thing I wanted to talk about really quickly was Wicked, specifically the film version of the musical version of the book, which was a remix of sorts of the original book that apparently was written in 1900, according to my research.
So what you're saying is that we are obligated to cover this on the show.
Yes, we are. But this has been in the works for a really long time. This is coming from Universal Pictures and working up on this for about a decade. At various points, they've been talking about Idina Menzel and Kristen Chenoweth reprising their roles. Unclear if that's going to happen. But the announcement was that John Chu is going to be taking over in the director chair. Interestingly enough, he recently dropped out of Willow for Disney very publicly, saying that like he's going to have a kid and it like doesn't work for scheduling. All of a sudden, Stephen Daldry, who was originally planning to direct Wicked, he dropped out of Wicked due to scheduling conflicts. And then John Chu was like, wait, I'm free, which I don't really know how that makes sense with his whole like Willow thing, but whatever. Anyways, it's definitely an upgrade for him. No offense to Willow fans, but it's the movie adaptation is going to have the original composer and lyrics person, I think, from the Broadway show. He's doing the screenplay. And supposedly there's going to be two new songs. But I guess my question, we've kind of talked about this, about Broadway adaptations in general a little bit. But one thing I see on Twitter, not just with this one, but in other Broadway kind of adaptations, is the notion that, and maybe it's the diehard segment, but that theater fans don't actually want adaptations. They just want professionally recorded versions of the staging, which I think you could argue was basically Hamilton, and people really received that well. And so I just kind of want to open that up for discussion about, are people going to accept this? On the one hand, it's the first, you know, film adaptation people are going to have. Like we talked about with Hamilton, it's going to allow people of all different, you know, backgrounds to be able to partake in it. Broadway and theater can be expensive, that kind of thing. So there's a little bit of pros and cons, but what do you think?
Yeah, I think it definitely depends on the thing. I am also a huge fan of Wicked. I went to see the show multiple times. I'm pretty sure I saw the show accidentally like four times when I was in college.
How do you see it accidentally?
Because I went to NYU and it was like one of those default bonding group activities freshman year. It was like, oh, you have free tickets to Wicked. And then I guess this was out of college. My first job in publishing was for Gregory Maguire's imprint publisher. And so we just got free tickets one time. It wasn't a thing that happened all the time, but I happened to like be around every time, every time free tickets were available. So I've seen it quite a bit, never with the original cast. I would have chopped off an arm and a leg to see Kristen Chenoweth and Idina Menzel in the original show. I understand why people are so precious about this particular one because the style is so distinct. And the vibe is very unique, and I'm not sure that its campiness would really translate well on film. But then I also look to things like In the Heights, which I'm very much looking forward to the adaptation of, and I think it's going to look amazing, I hope, but we haven't seen it yet, so like, this might just be wishful thinking, but I've never seen the Siege adaptation of that, and I'm really, really, really excited about the movie version. And then West Side Story, which started off as a theater play, stage play, and was adapted into one of the greatest films of all time. So I think you can like make a case for both, but I understand why people are so adamant about wanting like a high quality stage taping of this one. And I think that's just why it was so smart of the Hamilton people to have the foresight to know that people will want to see this one day with the original cast and like tape that.
Yeah, and I don't know how Broadway's handling, obviously, the pandemic right now, but I feel like I would pay for that, especially, you know, living in LA. There's obviously Pantages and there's that, but if you want to see, you know, original cast, stuff like that, or a current musical and you don't want to wait 5 years until it does a tour, especially in this climate, I feel like that would be a way to recoup losses. But I'm sure there's a lot of economics about the theater that I don't understand. But to your point, like in the Heights, so I also saw Wicked on stage in Pantages. So it was the tour group, not the original cast, obviously. But I haven't seen In the Heights. And so for me, I think another point is that it depends on who the audience is. Obviously for the diehards and people who have seen it, who are obsessed with the soundtrack, things like that, or the cast recordings, it might matter. But for someone like me, for In the Heights, for example, I've never seen it, so I won't have any frame of reference. I have wanted to see it. So for me, I'm just excited to be able to access it, right? So, and we should also mention that John Chu, who we just mentioned is going to be directing Wicked, is the director for In the Heights, coming out this summer on June 18 on HBO Max. And so that was definitely kind of how he's segued into this genre. So that'll be interesting to see. I think that'll be a good cue. Maybe it'll give some people comfort, depending on how they take that adaptation.
I'm excited about this pairing because I feel like John Chu is so good at doing very loud, colorful, personality-driven things.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm really excited to see what he's going to do with it. Have they announced any casting at all, or is it just they're like in talks with Kristen Chenoweth and Adina?
I haven't seen anything. The Adina and Kristen thing has been circling for years. Leah Michele obviously came up in the conversation during her Glee.
No.
Wait, we have to talk. We have to take a quick tangent here and discuss the Hunter Harris newsletter / thing that I think she's trying to do, where she gets together people and they discuss conspiracy theories. I don't know. I think I sent you this one. I screenshotted a bunch and sent to you. But one of the ones that's on there.
I just remembered.
I don't mean to make fun of illiteracy, okay?
Same.
It's, I'm sure, a very Same. Serious problem in
Yes.
parts all over the world. God bless Dolly Parton. She's done a lot to, you know, improve that stuff with books. However, one of the conspiracy theories out there that supposedly has been confirmed by many people on Broadway Twitter is that Leah Michele does not know how to read.
Okay, wait.
Which?
How is this even possible? Like, how is it possible?
I don't know. And again, while, you know, not to make light of any sort of something like that, it is just funny and light enough of a celebrity rumor that it's enjoyable, because you think about the Armie Hammer cannibal stuff and I'm like,
that's not fun. No.
This is just a girl who's an actress and been on Broadway, who's for sure had to read scripts and things, and they say she can't read. And supposedly many people are confirming this. It's just funny. It's just funny.
I mean,
sorry.
There's no way. I would be like, my mind would be so blown if this turned out to be true, because how does she learn her lines?
Unless she just has someone, I don't know, read it to her, or they just, I don't know. It doesn't seem feasible, but not everybody, but there's a large amount of people on the internet that are convinced this is true.
Oh my God.
Do you think she hid it from Corey? She just somehow pretended the whole time they were together, like, oh no, I can read. And then just,
I don't
how
know.
Do you hide something like
I don't
that from
know,
your partner?
But also,
I don't know.
Like, what about restaurant menus? What about
pictures? There's pictures, Stephanie.
Well, not all of them have pictures. And also, like, what about street signs? Like, I guess she's never had to drive because she's from New York, right? But is she in LA now?
I mean, wouldn't that be hilarious, though? Like, best kept secret that somehow she gets for the world and, like, doesn't know
I'm
how to
fascinated
read?
Fascinated by
Again,
this.
Not making fun. It's just, yeah, it's just, like, amazing that it's, people are just like, no, it's definitely true. Like, I can confirm. It's like, how do you know? Incredible. How do you, I guess you can, yeah, you just hand someone a piece of paper and say, can you read this? But anyway, moving on. I just have two other quick things. One, kind of wanted to talk about, we're not going to do an explainer on the GameStop situation. It's been done literally 100 times by now. The only reason I'm bringing it up in our context is just to talk about how crazy this story has gotten in the world of adaptation, so to speak. So there are currently 7 projects in the works as of today, 4 scripted and 2 documentaries. Of the scripted, we've got Brett Ratner, who bought the life story rights of the guy who is the founder of the Wall Street Bets Forum. We've got HBO, who has Jason Blum and Andrew Ross Sorkin, who is the co-creator of Billions. We've got, it related to our episode today, our spotlight, we have a Netflix project in which Noah Centineo is rumored to be starring in a major role. And the script is going to be by Mark Bull, who was the Oscar screenwriter and producer of The Hurt Locker. But the one that got me, the one that was just felt like peak book thing, and I want to get your take on, was Ben Mezrich, who wrote basically the book that was the basis of the Aaron Sorkin film, The Social Network. He wrote a book proposal called The Anti-Social Network, of which the Winklevoss twins are going to be executive producers. And that was bought by MGM. So like in the world of, in your world, I mean, I'm sure it's less crazy now, but I don't know. This to me felt like the most ridiculous of all of the announcements.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel very extreme, but I'm sadly not surprised.
Here's my question. Is there any earlier step? Because I feel like these projects are getting just so much more competitive. Are we going to see any sooner step in the process being bought? Is there an earlier stage, or is this like as early as somebody could possibly buy something?
What level of development are these things in right now?
Hard to say. They've just been announcing them, and I think they're just all racing to get them done. But just the notion that like the idea of a book that hasn't been written yet, or physically anything outside of a proposal, has already been purchased and they're developing an entire thing around
seems funny
to me, and like very peak.
Yeah, that does happen. It doesn't happen. I've seen it happen less on proposal for sure, but if the name is big enough, you know, and if the concept is high concept enough, yeah.
I'm just thinking of like, what's the next craziest version of this? Like, he writes a sentence on a napkin with just the title, and they're like, brilliant,
I'm
we'll buy
sure
it.
That's
like,
where we're headed. I'm sure. Or like, you know, an idea for a fictionalized podcast, and they're like, we love it, let's adapt it.
So anyways, coming to some screen eventually is one or all of these. Probably unlikely that all of them will survive, although we did get 2 Fyre Festival documentaries, so we'll see. The last thing I just wanted to say was, it's kind of a cheat corner, but not really. It just has nothing to do with anything except that it's the happy 1-year anniversary to Parasite winning Best Picture and 3 other Oscars about a year ago, which was, as they say, the last good thing in all caps, the pre-COVID. So just wanted to remember that moment. I watched a couple of, you know, I obviously rewatched the Jane Fonda reading it, and then just a couple of reaction videos, and it still made me emotional and kind of well up, because I remember where I was when I saw that. I definitely was like screaming my head off, and it was just a great moment. And so just want to say shout out to Bong Joon-ho and the cast and everybody. Great moment. Thank you. Happy anniversary.
Great moment. Happy anniversary. I also, this past weekend was the Super Bowl, which I did not remember, but I thought of you because our last Super Bowl we watched together, and I was like, holy fuck, that feels like it was yesterday, but also a million years ago. What happened? What is time? And I know this is not an original thought, because everybody's having this thought of what is time, but it's a little bit crazy to me that we've been stuck in this situation for a year.
It is crazy. It is crazy.
Moving on. My little news item is actually connected. It's a perfect segue into our spotlight, because Jenny Han announced on Twitter this week that Amazon Prime picked up her other book series, and we will soon be having that on our screens, which I'm excited about, for The Summer I Turned Pretty. And I have never read these, but I'm really excited to watch anything that involves Jenny Han or Jenny Han's writing. So that was just like a nice kismet thing that we get to talk about, leading into the third installment of To All the Boys I've Loved Before, Always and Forever.
Yeah, no, I definitely saw that and very excited for that as well. It was her first trilogy back in 2009 to 2011. To All the Boys was her latest trilogy. There's also a second trilogy in the middle, but To All the Boys was her latest one. The books were released 2014 to 2017. And then I just wanted to mention, just to tack on, that she, unlike To All the Boys, although she was kind of involved and, you know, there's pictures of her on set, there's obviously her cameos in all of the movies, but she's actually writing the script for the show for Amazon. And I believe she's also going to be co-showrunner, if I read the report correctly. So, you know, definitely stepping it up. And so, yeah, big congrats to her. We're really excited to see that when it comes out. Yeah, like you said, perfect segue into our spotlight, which is To All the Boys I've Loved Before, Always and Forever, which is the last of Jenny Hahn's, of that latest trilogy. We're checking back with Lara Jean and Peter Kavinsky, LJ and PK, as they are known to those of you that are familiar. And it's their senior year. I read the third book specifically. It's the only book of the series that I've read, just for crunch time before this pod. Stephanie, I think you read a little bit or might have listened to a little bit of the audiobook, but then we both watched an early screener of the movie last night, and we were just so excited to hop on and chat about it. I hadn't watched the second movie. I had a little trouble with it, to be honest, when it first came out. There was like a chemistry disconnect a little bit with Lana and Noah. It smoothed out in the rest of the film. Interestingly, when there was conflict, it got a lot better. But at the beginning, when it was just like mushy, like let's go on dates and go to the carnival, I was like, what is this? Anyways, love the first one. Like love. Literally watched it probably like 20 times in the first month that it came out back in 2018. Yeah, had a little trouble with the second one, but finally watched it in completion last weekend, and then was very happy with the third and final installment, which we watched last night. I felt it was a lot closer to the first one in terms of the chemistry, in terms of like just the overall tone. And maybe that was, I believe they filmed these back to back or kind of in close proximity to one another, the second and the third one. So I'm guessing maybe just they kind of got back into the groove of things, etc. So overall, really enjoyed it. It felt a lot like the first one in terms of like the little interactions and the relationships between the sisters and the family and everybody. They did change a lot. We're going to talk about it. But narratively, it kind of still reached the same themes, but details, they did change a lot.
Okay, well, the first movie, I, like everybody else on the internet, had a conniption and lost my brain and was completely obsessed with it. And I, like you, rewatched it maybe 20 times. And I also listened to the soundtrack over and over again. It had been so long since I had gotten that obsessive over something. It was just completely delightful. I loved their chemistry. I thought it was a perfect cream puff of a movie. And it was just the perfect 90 minutes of like just great chemistry. There was no sort of fat where anything dragged. I just loved it so much. And then the second one to follow up after that was obviously a huge disappointment. They tried their best, and I did really like the chemistry between Jordan Fisher and Lana Condor, actually. But I agree that the chemistry between Noah Centineo's character and Lana Condor's character was pretty off for the second one. And in general, the second one just like didn't work on a lot of different levels. But the third one, I would say, is like somewhere in between my love of the first and hatred of the second. And that would be my high level thought.
Yeah, I feel like anybody who, I've seen a couple people say this. I haven't gotten a full like general survey take on the reaction, especially because we saw early screenings and, you know, not everyone has seen it yet. But somebody said that their rankings was 3, 1, and 2. And I was like, that's impossible. There's no way you rank.
No.
There's no way you don't rank the first one first.
One is perfect.
Honestly.
If you rank 3 top, I question your judgment.
Yeah, similar to what you said. I feel like it is more rare these days to find like a perfect 90-minute rom-com. And this was that. I will also say this came out in August of 2018. It was like hashtag Asian August. And Always Be My Maybe had also just come out around that time with Ali Wong and Randall Park. And I loved that film also.
Was that the same year?
Yes. It was like basically the same month almost, I think. They were trying to get that hashtag Asian August thing to trend. I feel like I honestly just rewatched those two movies for like a solid 2 months. Just like back and forth, back and forth. And I will also mention that, kind of like what you were saying at the beginning, everyone in the world immediately Googled how old is Noah Centineo because we wanted to mm-hmm. just understand how icky we were supposed to feel about ourselves.
Is he over the age of 18 or not? Like, we
yeah,
need to know.
What's the status? I've done this with Tom Holland as well. But spoiler alert, they're all safe. I really enjoyed, for the most part, the third movie. I have to say the very opening, the opening song, Stephanie. Did you recognize the opening song?
Should I have? Am I a bad Asian for not recognizing
Stephanie,
the opening song?
Stephanie. The opening song of the third movie is Girls' Generation G from 2009. They open the movie in Korea and they are playing a K-pop song. I screamed when I watched this last night. I was so excited. It brought back a lot of memories from 2008 to 2012, which was my heyday of K-pop. They actually did play a second K-pop song at the bookend of that Korea scene. It's not a group I'm familiar with, but they're called Cherry Bullet. It was called Q&A. And they played Blackpink in the second movie.
Mm-hmm.
They played This Love. Also, if you're not up on it, go listen to the Dua Lipa Blackpink song, Kiss and Makeup.
Yeah, it's really good.
It slaps. It fucking slaps. The song is so fucking good. It's better than the ice cream song.
What about the Lady Gaga one, Sour Candy? How would you rank them?
Oh, I love Sour Candy. I would say Dua Lipa, then Gaga, then Selena.
I agree.
That Dua Lipa song is so good. But in general, I feel like most people have really, like you said, you listen to the soundtrack of the first movie a lot. I thought the music throughout the series have been really on point. So I was very excited about that. How did you feel about this revelation that not really a revelation because she's always been into books, but they reveal in the movie that her college major is English literature, and apparently it's her dream to release a what looks to be a young adult novel called Whoa Whoa Whoa, which, love that title, great meta. What did you think about that?
I mean, I think it's a trope I've seen before. A lot of writers write about wanting to be writers, or their main characters want to be writers because it's just happens to be the writerly experience. So I'm not that surprised. And I actually, you know, when it's done well, like, I think it's really funny. A lot about this movie hit, and actually the third book, and Jenny Han's experience in general hits like really close to home, like uncomfortably close for me. So I actually liked the fact that a lot of the details were changed for the movie, but even then, like, some of the details are like connected to different things in my life. So yeah, weird.
It is. All right, let's take a quick break, but then let's definitely talk about the book differences for this third one, because there's definitely a lot. Most of it is kind of minor, but there were some grapes, or maybe not grapes, but just things that I wish that they had found a way to include. So we'll talk about that after the break. We should back up a second. So I remember when the first movie came out, I specifically remember you and I having a conversation about where this movie was set, the movie specifically.
Yeah.
We were trying to play detective, and we were I remember I did like freeze frame on some of the addresses on the letters. I don't know if we specifically settled on Portland, but we definitely said, you know, Pacific Northwest for sure, probably mm-hmm. Oregon. But in the book, so I guess they're in, I didn't read the first one. Again, I only read the third one. Are they very specific about where? I'm assuming they're in Virginia.
They're in Virginia. I don't remember specifically where in Virginia they are or if she made up a place, but she is close enough to do a day trip to DC and then close enough to be close to Charlottesville. And those two things are actually pretty far away.
Okay.
And so I don't actually know where they are. Like, they might be in Richmond area, but like Richmond's also far away from DC. I am originally from Fairfax, Virginia, which is 20 to 30 minutes outside of DC. So I'm from a suburb of Virginia that is considered the DC metropolitan area. I've listened to the audiobook of the first book as well, and I started listening to the third one, and I had forgotten that this was based in Virginia at all. And then so when she started talking about wanting to go to UVA, I was like, oh my God, this is my high school experience. Like, I can't listen to this.
Yeah, so Jenny Han is from Richmond, I believe. correct. Mm. Do you know who's from Fairfax in the cast?
Ross Butler.
Ross Butler, that's right.
I think I knew that because I've definitely looked him up before, and that's like one of the highlights of this movie for me was Ross Butler looking fine.
Can we just talk about Ross Butler versus Charles Melton for a second?
Yes, let's have this out.
Okay, so here's my thing. Obviously, Charles Melton is like model gorgeous. And I'm not saying Ross Butler can't book campaigns. I'm just saying if you're looking for someone to walk Calvin Klein, Charles Melton and those lips. I mean, come on. The cheekbones, like the whole thing, right? Mm-hmm. But he's kind of like Scott Eastwood. Like very, very beautiful. But like how much are we going to get from him like acting wise? Like maybe one other movie. Ross Butler just seems much more approachable. And he just, I don't know. I think I'm Team Ross for the long haul.
I think I agree. We've already discussed my opinion of Charles Melton on this pod. I am sorry for how mean I was about him, but my opinion.
for the things I said when I was hungry.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm sorry because he's a real person and he doesn't deserve to be critiqued like this. But at the same time, my opinion hasn't changed. Like, I think he should 100% be a Tom Ford model and just drop the acting bit. But I generally agree with your analysis. And I would also pick Ross Butler over Charles Melton. I mean, I think it depends. Like, honestly, I don't know that I could make a decision without having like 30-minute one-on-ones with each of them and like a quick interview.
I'm sorry. I need to do like a quick round of like speed dating. It's just the only way, like in a closed restaurant with like
this.
A personal waiter with wine. There's no other scientific way to do it. Yeah.
I need to know their hopes and dreams. I need to know their personality. I need to know if they read and what they read if they read.
Ross Butler has been very vocal recently about all the kind of anti-Asian violence. He's trying to be an activist, if that puts any points in his column.
Yes. I mean, I love Ross Butler. I watched all of 13 Reasons Why, even though the last season of 13 Reasons Why was trash the last couple of seasons.
Tell us how you really feel.
And largely because he was in that. And I was also really upset when he decided to jump from Riverdale to continue doing 13 Reasons. But then we would not have gotten Charles Melton had he not done that. So, you know.
Yeah. Actually, quick tangent. So here's my question, because I watched most of season one of Riverdale and I enjoyed it for what it was, right? And then it just jumped the shark, the like murder thing. Yes. Like I just couldn't, whatever. What I'm hearing is that they're doing a 7-year time jump.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, do I jump back in?
I will if you will.
We're going into the deep end, my friend.
Yeah, why don't we do it as part of the pod? We can do
for
it as
science.
Part of the pod.
For science.
For science. I also watched the first season and then I think maybe the season or two following that. And then I just kind of got confused. And then I tried to jump back in without having gone back and watched anything. And I was just so confused. And I usually can do that sometimes, depending on what the show is, because I don't really care about missing stuff. Depending on what it is, if it's like just a fluffy show that I just watch because the people are pretty, like I don't really care about the plot, so it doesn't bother me. But this was so bad that I was just like, all right, I give up.
It's just one of those things where when you read the Wikipedia entry and it's confusing, you know it's convoluted, and I just like couldn't, like the whole Scooby-Doo like whatever, I just wasn't into it. This is what happened to Rain. Like I just want you guys to do the steamy hot people. We don't need to do political machinations. Like, this is not Game of Thrones. Just, this is not Henry the Seventh or whatever. Let's not.
How long did I watch Rain for? Maybe like the first 3 seasons?
Wow. Yeah. I think I did the first 2. Oh, shout out to Megan Follows, who was the mom in Rain, the queen in Rain.
Oh.
Who was Anne of Green Gables, which is referenced both in this third book. LJ calls Gilbert Glythe her dream man. And also, Gia Tolentino, who's also UVA alum, also mentions Anne of Green Gables in her book, Trick Mirror. Just wanted to drop that in because Anne of Green Gables was one of like my favorite things growing up. It was the mini series that I think was on CBC, I want to say, and they reared it on PBS. So another tangent. Okay, no more tangents. Sorry, we've done three tangents and now we have to get back.
No, wait, like I want to, no, I'm interested. I've never watched or read Anne of Green Gables. Why?
Why? So I've never read the books either. Someone gifted me the first book because they know how much I love the miniseries, but it's just for some reason something that I grew up watching with my sisters a lot. And we had like the tapes and I've just seen it a million times. And maybe not shocking, both Jenny Han and Gia Tolentino like it. The character ends up being a writer, another writer character. But she's kind of this like spunky red-haired orphan who ends up kind of warming the hearts of this little town in, I think, Nova Scotia. And it just kind of follows her as she grows up from like a teen into a young woman. And one of the boys in her town is Gilbert Blythe. He's kind of the boy next door, is really smart, tall, dreamy. Spoiler alert, they get together at the end. Their very last scene in the end of the miniseries is on this bridge. And he has this like little speech that he says to her. I have watched that speech on YouTube 1,000 times. Like I could do it verbatim. It is like one of the most romantic endings of a series that I can think of. And it's just so sweet. And I love it so much. And they redid it. Well, not they redid it, but they did another adaptation on Netflix called Anne with an E. Mm-hmm. And I fucking refuse to watch it. I just can't. Megan Follows is like number one for me. The only one.
I love hearing about your childhood passions.
Yeah, I put it on the slate for us to maybe redo it, but I just don't think I can bring myself to watch the Netflix one. It just looks awful. I'm sorry.
I mean, if you don't put yourself through torture, man.
There's a limit to science, okay? Maybe I'll read the book and maybe we could do it, but we'll see.
I mean, I say that, but aren't we requiring ourselves to watch West Side Story when it comes out?
I know. But then we get to rewatch West Side Story. We just have to. But okay, so getting back to all the boys. Tons of differences from the book. As we're talking about, the location is different. So instead of Richmond or the Virginia area, they live in Portland. So all the schools are different. So in the book, It's like William and Mary, UVA, UNC. In the movie, it's Berkeley, UCLA, NYU, and Stanford.
Let me ask you a question. As somebody who grew up in Virginia, and Virginia is very much known for its very good public university system, so like all of this, the schools that she mentions in the book are ones that I was deeply familiar with and were all my safety schools. The kind of stereotypical thing to say was all the smart kids got into UVA and then everybody else went to Virginia Tech, which I don't think holds true now anymore because I think Virginia Tech's gotten harder to get into and whatnot. But that's what it was back then. Virginia Tech really was only known for football and unfortunately the shooting, which isn't funny. I don't know why I'm like laughing. I think I laugh when I'm uncomfortable. So just, you know, I'm uncomfortable. But so I guess my question is, how familiar were you with those schools? Or are those just mainly East Coast schools?
Yeah, definitely don't have a sense in terms of like vague rankings, which of course you could debate that rankings of any kind are arbitrary or objective. UVA and UNC, I definitely know probably more from like the sports world. Obviously UNC Tar Heels for basketball, the Michael Jordan of it all, you know, long legacy there. William and Mary I've heard of, but if you had asked me like what the reputation was or trying to do some sort of ranking, I wouldn't have known. So I definitely leaned on the book to kind of infer those things. Question back to you, in terms of how they paired up the swaps, did you feel like it kind of was accurate? So it's Stanford instead of UVA, William and Mary instead of Berkeley, and UNC instead of NYU. Now, part of that might have been geographically kind of with what they were trying to do, but did they kind of line up like reputation wise or not really? Maybe it's just geography.
Man, like, I don't know. I feel like I would rank all those schools differently. Hold on. So in the book, does she end up going to UNC?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Which is way different than having a cross-country relationship.
Yeah.
Sorry, let's just skip ahead. Let's just talk about the ending.
Yeah.
Thoughts.
Like, I really want them to make it, but, and I do know, for the record, I know of a couple who were high school sweethearts and they went to separate colleges. They broke up during the 4 years of college. and they very maturely decided, okay, like, if we still miss each other after these 4 years and we still want to be together, we'll figure out a way to be together after college. But those 4 years of college, were they were free to do what they wanted. So I feel like it was a very mature arrangement. And then they ended up getting back together after college, and now they're married and have a kid. And so it is not unheard of for this to happen, but I just, like, for my own sense of, like, security and safety, I selfishly really wish that they had done, like, a cut to 5 years later and shown them together.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't even think of that. Just give us the little coda epilogue, and just that would really be the fairy tale ending, right?
Yeah, because that's what they did for in The Sun Is Also a Star, too, is, like, they get separated. Yeah,
that's right.
But then they end up together and ended up having babies, and you see all that at the end, and you're just, like, kind of soothed by the happy ending. And I just wanted that soothing moment, because the way it ends, like, I know Lara Jean says what she says, and she's like, we're not all couples or whatever, but in my head I'm thinking, okay, honey. Good luck.
And, like, he says it in the scene, and this is the movie. He says it, which is different from how it happened in the book a little bit, but he says it in the movie, like, I'd rather break up now than, like, 3 months into the school year or 6 months into the school year or whatever, which is, like, I'm sorry. It's definitely how it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying they're not going to be meant to be, like, all that, but it just, I honestly... And, like, at me on Twitter. But, like, as I was watching this, I was actively cheering for them to stay broken up.
I really wish, I know that they don't know my friends, so, like, they wouldn't be able to know that this happened and model their lives after my friends. And these are fictional people, so I don't even know what I'm talking about. But I really wish that they had taken that arrangement and kind of come to, like, the contract was, okay, we're going to take the 4 years apart. We're going to do our thing and grow as people. And anything that happens in the 4 years stays within the 4 years. And if after we get out of college, we still want to be together, we're going to come back and, like, talk it out and decide whether or not we're going to be together and figure out a way to be together. I feel like that, and, like, that would have worked as, like, a contract situation, right? Like,
100%. And, like, in the book, it's different because in the book, you know, she's going to UNC, he's going to UVA, which is, I think, only a 3.5 hour difference, according to what they keep referencing.
Absolutely nothing.
And but, like, part of the things they're writing, he writes in the amended contract in here, your book is, like, you know, Lara Jean, like, I'm just kind of paraphrasing, but, like, so-and-so will write so-and-so one letter a week and call every day, whatever. That's not in the movie. I don't even know what the amended contract is, just that they're unbroken up. Like, it doesn't even make sense. Like, they just kind of try to maintain that part of the story, but, and then just kind of stuff it in there, which didn't make sense. And to your point, first of all, mazel tov to them. Like, that sounds amazing.
Right?
Super mature. I love that. That just sounds great for everyone's personal growth. Makes them stronger as individuals. You come back stronger as a couple, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Here's the thing. While I'm not satisfied by the ending personally, I kept wondering, does it make sense for these characters, though? And Lara Jean is just such a fantastical, like, romantic. And while she shows some growth in being a little bit more grounded, in releasing control, in trying to understand that something's happened in life and learning to be independent, yada, yada, yada. I mean, at the end of the day, as she says, I still hold on to things. She's still very much that romantic person. And so, like, for me, as much as I didn't like it, I was like, I guess it makes sense for her. I feel like I would know that girl. And that girl's like, no, but we're going to make it work. And it's just like, at that point, all you can do is just, like, smile and in your head just say, oh, sweetie. Like, you know, what are you going to do? What are you going to do?
Oh, my God. But does it make sense for him? Like, girls are going to be crawling all over him in college.
I mean, he was already getting a locker full of Valentines in the second movie while they were still together, and they're just in high school. He's going to be, like, a star, like, potentially star of a lacrosse team at Stanford? Like, come on. I don't know. Okay, sorry. Let's also talk about this difference. The birds and the bees, okay?
Okay, wait. Okay, so I didn't get that far in the book, so how does it happen in the book? Because I have feelings about how it happened in the movie.
They don't have sex in the book.
Oh. Why do you think they did that in the movie?
I have no idea. I have no idea. Because to me, showing that scene, and even if it's just like 2 minutes and showing them like the classic, our clothes are off and we're under the covers, like after that, to me just feels peddling, just like kind of the regular American mainstream, like we just have to show the skin kind of thing. And this series and this book has never screamed that to me. Like, she is much more, the character's always been much more prudent and like prudish a little bit and just conservative, and they've never painted that as wrong. Like, it's always just been like, that's just her, she's just really sweet, blah 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 blah. It felt completely unnecessary to me, and not that it was like over sexualized or anything like that, but just it didn't make sense why they felt like they needed to add that in from something that didn't happen in the book. So the same scene happens where she basically tries to get it going and he's like, no, I something feels weird. It doesn't happen at prom. It happens at beach week, which they completely cut from the movie for time, which is fine. But it's the same, like, thematically, like, she wants to do it, she's ready, he's like, I feel uncomfortable and whatever. But then that scene at the end where, like, after the wedding and his, conveniently, the dad and Trina are gone and they do it, the scene doesn't happen. That doesn't exist in the book.
Okay, so here are the things that I don't like about that scene in the movie, other than the fact that it is clearly extremely out of character and they added it in for no reason. Why the fuck do they have to have sex for the first time in her childhood bed?
Oh my God.
I just, like, everybody goes to an after party at a hotel at a prom to have sex. Or prom is conveniently at a hotel and they can have sex. Why? Why does she have to have sex in her bedroom next to her dad and her stepmom and when her, like, baby sister's across the hall? Like, what?
Thank you for bringing this up. This is an important point. I should have elaborated more. So in the book, there is a beach week, which happens, I believe, after graduation, where all the seniors go to, like, the shore-ish type area and they all rent houses, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where the scene happens. And very early in the book, he actually asks her, hey, how come we only hook up at my house? And she specifically says, the character Laura Jean says, because something to the effect of, I feel weird about doing this in my childhood room.
Mm-hmm. See?
To your point, why does she try to do, someone who's so careful, she doesn't break curfew, she always scoots him out. Daddy's home.
Yeah.
Okay, Laura Jean? And you're trying to do it in your father's house? What are you doing? Like, No. It's a no for me. I didn't like that change. I didn't like either of those changes.
And also in the book, at least the part that I listened to, Margot brings home a boyfriend from college.
Oh, Ravi!
Yeah, and the dad's like, and Margot is very adamantly like, oh no, he's staying with me in my room. And the dad is like, no. So I just feel like that totally would not fly in that household. And I don't understand why they couldn't just, like, figure out some sort of logistical other situation.
Yeah. Also, like, I kind of wish that they had Ravi. I like that character. I know it was small and stuff, but yeah. That was another change from the book. Basically, all of the Trina stuff is cut out. There's no Ravi, and they kind of supplement that with other stuff, which here's another thing I felt like was unnecessary. You know, it was fine. I just didn't understand why they did it, and it didn't do anything for me. Kitty's whole, like, I have a boyfriend that I met in Korea thing.
Yeah.
None of that happens in the book. Kitty just is her regular, like, side character and just, like, kind of chiming in and just does her bit, which is perfect. Why they felt the need to add this little, like, relish in that only exists for, like, a minute and a half total for the movie, like, I didn't understand that. I don't know. That was a question mark for me.
I think, you know what I think that was? I think that was a direct response to criticism that the first movie got, that none of the boys that Lara Jean sent letters to were Asian boys. So I think that they were trying to say, and that's also why I think they brought Ross Butler in to be Chrissy's boyfriend. And I think that's probably why they gave Kitty a little Korean boyfriend.
And probably why they, slightly different, but related, like why they recast John Ambrose.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, like, that, I didn't connect that until I rewatched the first one. I was like, wait a minute, he's super white in the first one.
Yep. You know, in the first one when they have like a mid or post credit scene where John Ambrose actually shows up, do they still have that in the first, at the end of the first one?
Yes. They just straight up recast him and like never said why.
I would have thought Netflix would have been a little bit more like sneaky and just would have tried to like cut him out of the first one.
Or like if you weren't sure of him, just do a like a much more suspenseful, like show the back of somebody or show somebody receiving. Like there was a lot of ways they could have done that without showing the face. And so it was really, I mean, it was fine because Jordan Fisher is amazing.
I love Jordan Fisher.
His chemistry was great with her. When he's playing the piano, I'm like, oh my God, don't let him sing because that's just not fair. Like she would just want to be with him.
His chemistry with her in the second movie is so good that I was like, I think they should be together.
When she like sees him at the senior home and she like trips and stuff. Mm-hmm. Also, can we just talk about that senior home? Why is it like a mansion with like West Elm velvet chairs everywhere? Like who lives here?
I don't know.
Or do these kinds of places exist?
I don't think anything in the movie is supposed to be realistic.
I guess, but like, anyways, also Stormy is apparently his grandmother in the book.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So instead of the Trina stuff, what they definitely did different in the movie is that they really brought to full circle this whole thing with Jen.
Yeah, I loved that though.
Yeah, like she compliments her shoes at the beginning of the movie, which was kind of a callback to the first one where she insulted her combat boots. She's like not in the book at all, basically. But the whole thing with like the NYU stuff. And even how they handled their relationship in the second one, I really liked that. And I enjoy that despite having to sacrifice some of the Trina stuff, which I'll say the one thing that I wanted from the Trina stuff was the bachelorette scene. I don't know if you got that part to the audiobook.
I didn't get that far, but I also have a thing from the book that I wish they had kept the same. Do your Trina thing first.
So there's a bachelorette party. It's not like the standard Vegas thing. They basically go to a karaoke room. Yeah.
Want to see a Norebang scene?
Yeah, unclear if it's like that. They just called it a private karaoke room in the book, but I assume it's Norebang. Kitty doesn't come because she's too young. She ends up going to like the boys' like steakhouse dinner that Peter organizes for her dad because he's like trying to suck up, basically. Anyways, there's a bunch of Trina's friends. Lara Jean sneaks in some sips of people's drinks, and she basically ends up drunk. And it's just like really funny, and I just wish they kept it.
That would have been really funny. I wish they had kept that too. Also, this is the thing that I wish that they had kept from the book is that Margot is like way less well-adjusted in the book about Trina. And I think that that would have been more realistic. Margot's very hesitant to accept Trina and she's really weirded out when their dad proposes to her. And I think that that reaction just like makes sense. She's been in Scotland and all of a sudden this new woman is like in their house, all up in her territory while she's been gone. And I just don't think Mona from Pretty Little Liars's reaction in the movie was at all real. It was like way too well adjusted, like way too well adjusted. And I think all they do is Trina says something about, I'm sorry, I'm in your house. And she says, it's our house now. And then they like squash it. And I'm like, that's not how that would go, but that's fine.
Yeah. On the day or the day before of the wedding. Like, yeah, I completely agree. And actually, this is where I think they could have, if, I mean, I hear your point and the point about like, I guess, diversity of the love interest. But if it was a matter of giving Kitty something else to do, this is where I actually think it would have been much more organic and true to the book. Is part of what kind of brings Margot around a little bit is how much Kitty adores Trina. And that makes sense because she was only two when the mom, like the birth mother passed away. This is kind of like, aside from having like the sisters obviously kind of raised her, she just really gets attached to Trina. And I think that could have been a very emotionally satisfying plot line. I was thinking about it last night. I feel like they're just trying to keep it very simple. Like, we only want you to care about one main emotional thread, and then we'll kind of do the Peter and dad stuff at the end. But like, we don't want you to get distracted. But which, I don't know, I felt like they could have handled a little bit more complexity, but I kind of understood why they did it. But I would have loved to see that too. I totally agree with you.
Yeah. Well, and also, I love Peter's dad, the actor, because he's in Haunting of Hill House and he's that little kid from E.T.
Oh, yeah.
So I love him, but I felt like he was like super stiff in this. He and Noah Centineo just didn't have good chemistry, and maybe that was on purpose because he's, you know, this deadbeat dad coming back. And in my head, I think because of the internet ruining me, I was like, oh, what a missed opportunity to not get Mark Ruffalo for this.
Jesus. He has enough work, Stephanie.
But, like, is it my fault that the internet has influenced me so?
Like, also, he would have been way too likable.
You can't. I don't know. Mark Ruffalo has played some douchebags.
Yeah.
He has range.
No, I mean, I get that. He played twins.
This is like one day of work, you know?
Yeah.
One day probably for him.
Yeah.
He couldn't have done a cameo.
You're right. But speaking of the diner, which is where Peter and his dad meet in the movie, here's the other scene that they didn't put in the movie that I wish they did, which I think, to your point about missed opportunity, was a complete missed opportunity for a great callback to the first movie. In the book, I don't know if you've gotten here yet, but Peter arranges a surprise at the diner. I believe it's after prom at midnight, which is Lara Jean's birthday. And it's essentially a 16 candles recreation. All her friends are there to surprise her. They have the cake on the table. They like have them get on the table, like recreate the photo. And it's so, so cute reading it in the book. And I really, really wish that they had done it. And I can't believe they robbed us of that gif of them doing that, because they mentioned the whole Jake Ryan thing. He talks about why they liked the movie in the first one. And he's like, I'm way cuter than that guy. So instead of 16 candles, they do a say anything thing.
Say anything. It's not as good. It's not as good.
It's not. So that was my number one wish they had done it in the movie.
Well, I think maybe if I were the writers, I would have been kind of scared to recreate that scene, because that Jake Ryan scene with Molly Ringwald on the table with the birthday cake, I mean, it's the best part of the movie. It is.
It's not untouchable, Stephanie. I believe they redid it with Dan Levy and the actor who plays his love interest on Schitt's Creek, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't remember that. They did the cake scene?
I believe so. It can be done.
I don't know. Because it is, that scene is the thing that like makes the entire movie excusable. And, you know, we've talked about how the entire movie is like not excusable. Like, it's terrible.
So many parts. So many parts, not just the long duck dong, the panties.
Just like
there's a lot.
Everything with Jake Ryan's girlfriend.
Oh God!
Oh my God! It's so bad.
It's so bad. It's so bad. It does not age well at all.
No, but I love that ending scene. It like always makes me cry.
Okay, I get that it's an iconic scene. However, to me, the scene I actually like better is when he's outside. Like, he's in front of his car with his hands in his pockets.
Oh, my God.
Like
in front of the red car. Oh, my God.
That part, that is Jake Ryan to me. Like, the candle thing is, yes, iconic. But, like, it's her opening the door and him. And she, like, does the whole, like, me? And she, like, turns around. And he goes, yeah, you. And he, like, chuckled. Oh, my God. It kills me. That is so, so good.
Now I feel that like is, I have to that rewatch is the part 16 for me. Candles. Yeah. Now I feel like I have to rewatch it. But I think they couldn't do that because Noah Centineo already did that in Sierra Burgess is Not a Loser, which that movie is terrible.
Oh, yeah. He did. I didn't watch it for reasons such as that. Exactly. Because people said it was bad.
But actually, another little tidbit I loved from the movie, and I actually really did love his letter to her and the yearbook. I don't know. For some reason, it reminded me of Felicity and the whole beginning scene in the pilot of Felicity when Ben is writing his letter to her and she decides to go to NYU. And I think Noah Centineo did a really good job of delivering that. But the little flashback scene he has remembering when they met and our little friend, Claudia Kishi.
Mamona Tamada.
So cute. Is playing young Lara Jean. And I just thought, good for you, Netflix. Genius casters.
She always crushes it with the Halloween costumes because they put her in that, like, I think they dress her as like a piece of toast, is it?
Oh my
in the
God.
Second movie. And in the Babysitter's Club, they do the crow. Just fabulous.
She's just
loved
absolutely
it.
So adorable. And I cannot wait to see. I really hope somebody protects her. And that she is able to transition into adult acting, because I can't wait to see what she does when she's older.
Protect her at all costs. At all costs. Only other two things that I want to talk quickly about from the differences, so to speak, is they have a dog in the book, okay?
They have a dog in the movie.
So Trina has a dog in both the book and the movie, but the Coveys have a dog in the book. Jamie Foxx Pickle. He's a Wheaton Terrier. And in the movies, Dr. Covey shuts it down in the first one. Remember? They're at the airport and Kitty's like, can we get a dog now? And he's like, no, but nice try.
Wait, what is that? You know when Lara Jean falls over to... What dog is that?
That's Trina's dog.
Oh, what's his name?
I forget. He's adorable too. Oh, and did you notice that he's in the background at the wedding?
Yeah.
So cute. They put him on a little couch on the bride's side. So cute.
So cute.
The other thing that I really am glad that they did in the movie that they didn't do at all in the book, which I was completely surprised at, is they like just completely skip Korea. She doesn't mention anything about Korea in the book.
Oh.
They talk about what they're going to do, but she doesn't describe it. There's nothing.
I honestly feel like that is a product of the time in which this was published.
Go on. Say more.
I feel, and again, this is me just sort of surmising. I don't know for sure, but my guess is that Jenny Han made her characters half white and half Korean so that they would be more relatable.
Mm.
And probably didn't mention Korea because people weren't really looking for POC stories at the time. That would be my guess. I don't know. And I don't know Jenny Han personally. And I don't know her publisher. And I'm not trying to insinuate anything. But it kind of makes sense to me that they would add all of this Korea stuff in now because it's so quote unquote trendy.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And it's definitely fits into their aesthetic. Their aesthetic is like very Gen Z, very colorful, very pop. And so Korean cafes and like beauty products and pastry shops, all of that fits into like the Lara Jean aesthetic. So
yeah. And white people didn't know about K-pop when this book came out. I literally had a conversation at one of my last jobs with a colleague when K-pop, BTS and Blackpink were exploding over here. And she was like, are you into K-pop? And I was like, I was in the 90s, and she was like, oh, K-pop existed in the 90s?
Justice for the Hallyu wave. Look it up, people.
Yeah, so it's certainly, and I, in my head, I was kind of like, yeah, Eastern culture did exist before white people discovered it. That's fine. I think it's way more trendy now, and they are wanting to capitalize on that, and there are certain ways to feel about that. But overall, I feel like it's a positive change.
Yeah, and they even included that very, it's literally a one-liner that obviously doesn't fit in with what the story is about and what people probably are tuning in for. But she does have that quick thing that she says to Peter while they're FaceTiming is that like people started talking to her in Korean, assuming that she understood. And then when she struggled and didn't know what to say, she felt odd about that. And I think that's, I can almost say without a doubt, is a universal experience for any of us who have roots in Asia that have visited our maternal, paternal homelands and felt like an other in our own culture, so to speak.
That literally happened to me when I was driving in K-Town in 2012 in LA. I was in the Galleria parking lot and I was like trying to get out. And this Korean adjacent comes up to me and he's trying to help me. And then I can only like answer him in English. And he like basically scolded me for not being able to speak Korean.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've all been there, girl. We've all been there.
Yeah. The thing in the Filipino culture is slightly different. They say that there's some sort of smell. Look this up. I'm not making this up. They say that there's like a smell that's different. And I'm sure it's also appearances and how you dress and things like that. But when you are visiting the Philippines as an American or somebody who grew up in the States, like you're not ever confused almost ever for somebody who's grown up in the Philippines. And there's a term for that. It's called balik bayan, which is big brown box that's commonly used for people who visit from the States, who go to the Philippines and are both bringing American goods in bulk to the Philippines and vice versa, bringing home like pasalubong, which is basically souvenirs from the trip back to their relatives who live in the States. The balik bayan term is often used for somebody who referred to as like a Filipino, like American, who somebody who clearly is not from around there and walking around at the mega malls and just in general in Manila. So it's definitely relatable.
What are some of your grapes?
No, I want to hear yours. You texted me as we were both watching the screening saying, I have my first grape. And I was like, save it. I want to hear it on the pod. So what is it?
Okay. I am extra disappointed in the entire team involved because they fucking repeated the same grape that they committed in the first movie, which is as follows. In the first movie, Lara Jean and I think his name is Luke, the gay one.
Yes, Lucas.
Lucas. It's like during the ski trip and they're doing Korean face masks together. And when they take off the face mask, Luke wipes the entire mask off with a fucking towel. And I'm fucking mortified because I'm like, no, bitch, pat that shit in. Pat it in. It's like very important. It is very expensive skincare product that you're wiping off your face. That is not what you're supposed to do. And then they fucking do it again in this one. When Lara Jean comes back from Korea and she's giving Peter Kavinsky all of his souvenir presents, he has a sheet mask on and he takes it off and then he pats it off with a fucking towel. And I'm telling everybody right now that that is not how you do a Korean face mask. Pat that shit in.
Very important public service announcement, everybody. I want you to pay attention and listen to this woman. She knows what she's talking about.
Pat that shit in. It's very expensive product that is good for your skin. Do not wipe it off.
Yeah.
Okay? That's all I have to say.
I mean, just think about it like moisturizer. You wouldn't moisturize your entire face off and then just like wipe it off with a towel. The whole point is that you want it to sink in. So you just gently kind of like massage it in. It's very nice feeling. You know, if you put your face mask into the refrigerator, which I highly recommend, and then you kind of like pat it in nicely afterwards, it's very relaxing. No towels, people. No towels.
Also, Noah Centineo acted like it kind of hurt to peel the face mask off, and I guarantee you they never hurt, so.
Another great point. Had no idea what that was about. He was acting like he had hand sanitizer on his face. What are you talking about?
Like Jenny Han, somebody who's Korean, like Lana Condor, you're Asian.
Lana loves Korean face masks. She should know this.
Somebody needed to be there to like say something. I'm so upset. This is, I'm so offended.
Honestly, this is one of your best scrapes, I have to say. Like in a weird way. Like I'm very proud of you. Like this is like, important information that we're giving the people right now.
I was just like, the minute I was like, obviously it was a big deal to me when the first movie came out, and it still annoys me every single fucking time Lucas rubs it off, and that sounds so dirty, but like to see it again was just so fucking insulting. It was so insulting. I'm done now. We can wrap up my grape. What are your grapes?
I'll be honest. I didn't really have any. I was going to do like a Diana's food corner where I like basically give hot takes in all the food places that Lara Jean thinks is cool in New York.
Oh my God, let's do
that. But there aren't that many. Okay, so Little Cupcake Bake Shop where her and Peter meet. And I think that's where she tells him she didn't get into Stanford. It's fine. It's fine, people. It's in West Village. It's very cute, blah, blah, blah. It's okay. Magnolia, which they also get cupcakes from, is much better, although I will say she didn't get the fucking banana pudding, and that is the entire point of going to Magnolia, okay? If you're in the Los Angeles area, you are lucky. They have a Magnolia in West Hollywood. Go there. Do not order anything unless it includes the banana pudding. Otherwise, you're doing it completely wrong. Completely wrong. Also, can I...
That's also a rookie mistake. Like, why would, like... Somebody should have told them if you go to Magnolia's, you get the banana pudding.
Well, I feel like that's also like inaccurate because someone like Lara Jean probably has like researched the shit out of it. And like she should know from Yelp and like food blogs that like that's the thing that you get. Also, apparently somebody said on Twitter that the Magnolia banana pudding recipe is the exact same one as Nabisco, except for like two different things. But it's like the exact same. Like somebody who worked at the company. And like everyone was like, oh my God, mind blown. So, hot tip, that's Google that.
That's so funny.
Life hack. My other thing is that, okay, they cover a lot of ground in their Manhattan tour. Well, although it seems like they kind of are in Brooklyn for parts of it. Probably doable, except for the Levan cookie. Also, they don't say Levan. They say it a different way, which is weird. Which, there are now two locations, but the original one, which I assume she would want to go to because that's her kind of character, is very far from everything else they're doing. They're mostly in Midtown, they're in Union Square, and then they're downtown. Like, so her and Chris must have taken a cab just to get the cookie because there's no way they did that. Yeah, I don't see them schlepping the entire class just to go to Levan.
But also, Have you ever seen somebody lug an entire couch on a subway?
No, but I have seen videos of some pretty crazy stuff being brought onto the subway. But the couch is a little ridiculous.
Well, yeah. Like, all I thought when I saw that was, like, you definitely have bed bugs now. Like, why is this worth moving?
Completely agreed. So. Also, like, very minor detail, but the fact that Chris brings this huge trunk to New York is completely out of character.
Yeah.
In the book, when she leaves for Costa Rica, she's like, is that all you're bringing? She's like, yeah, I'm just going to buy that. Like, there's no way she brings that ginormous trunk with her to Manhattan. There's no reason Chris would do that.
Also, like, who would bring a fucking trunk to Manhattan with them with no wheels on the bottom? Like, I understand the trunks don't have wheels on the bottom, but my point is, it's fine if she wanted to bring a massive thing of luggage. Fine. Girl needs her shit. Fine. But at least be pragmatic about it and make sure your luggage has wheels.
Yeah, I feel like that's a thing that Lara Jean would do because it's, like, vintage and she bought it from Etsy. But, like, again, not in character for Chris. So that was
exactly
a little weird.
This did make me miss New York a lot, though. Did it make you miss New York?
100%.
Yeah.
When they're on the charter bus and they, like, or in the bus, I should say, and they first get to the city, I just got chills. And I just remember, it's weird because you live there a lot longer than me, but I had always heard the saying of, like, when you are coming in from, like, the airport, let's say, and you're coming into the city and you don't get that, like, tingle in your body, you know, it's ready to leave. You're ready to leave. And I definitely got to that point by the time I left. But this was probably the first time in a long time where, like, I kind of got that feeling back. And I was like, oh, I miss New York so much. And I really can't wait till I can go back and visit because, I mean, there really just isn't anything like it.
Yeah, I was in my head the whole time. I was like, fuck, New York's always going to be my main bitch, no matter what.
Oh, the one that got away.
I know, she is the one that got away.
Just to close out, because we never really did an official episode on the first movie, and this has become such a, like, an iconic series, I just wanted to end with maybe our favorite parts from the first one.
Aw.
There are so many, but I don't know, what are some of the ones that come to mind?
When they were doing the retrospective at the end of this one, I think my heart...
Oh, my God. Oh, it was so cute.
So cute. My favorite part of the movie is and will always be when PK twirls Lara Jean around by her butt pocket and says, and then whispers into her ear, good job. That is the best part of the movie. I fucking love it. But then also the hot tub scene is just like,
woo,
so steamy. Like the chemistry is so off the charts. And I'm just like, I'm honestly afraid to rewatch the first movie because I don't want to all of a sudden not feel like those things hit the same way. Because the way that I felt the first 20 times I watched the movie was...
The 21st one is going to be different though.
But like, it's just like one of those things. Like, I think I've tried to explain this to you a couple of times where like I can watch Set It Up whenever, wherever, so many times to fall asleep because it's a delightful movie, but I don't care that much about it. But like, I haven't been able to watch The First to All the Boys since 2019 because I'm just afraid the next time I watch it will be the time it loses its magic to me. And it was so magical that
yeah,
I just want to keep it there.
No, that totally makes sense. I will say for me, it still hit the same way. When he's flipping the water, when he's like basically trying to tell her I like you without saying it, she kind of says something and he's like, oh, you're impossible. And he kind of like flips the water. And then after she like mounts him and says, there is no one like you, Covey, it's great. It's fantastic. And can I just read the quote to go back to your first thing about the twirling? Can I just read the mm-hmm. quote that she says is the inner monologue?
Mm-hmm.
It's weird and somewhat off-putting to be congratulated on doing nothing more than accepting a note and having an ass pocket for someone to stick their hand into. But I guess that's where my life has taken me. I mean... That's great, everybody. That is a great line. Okay.
That is such a great line.
That's a rewatch right there. That's something you rewatch for sure.
Oh my God. There's something about that good job that gets me every time. I don't know what it is.
Because it's very like clandestine and just very like, oh, it's just so cute. And like they have their own little thing. I'll also say, like, I really liked Dr. Dan. His scenes in the first one were really great. Like, the one where he's eavesdropping on Lara Jean and Chris talking about the ski trip. Chris saying, like, oh, I've never seen you happier than this, LJ. Mm. And the dad's like, yeah, she's right. It's just really cute. And then also when he's dropping her off for the ski trip and he tries to give her the sex talk and give her the condoms. Lana Condor just does such a great job.
Oh my God, her facial expressions are amazing. They were just as good in this third one. Oh my God.
She was so good.
She's such a good comedic actor.
When she says, sparkler send off, please, that's my one request in this third one.
Also, when she like falls over the dog and then Tree.
Oh my God, so good.
Tree is like, is she okay? The dad says something like, I haven't gotten used to it yet. And Tree goes, it seems like you're pretty used to it. I just, for some reason, that cracked me up so much. Like, so good.
Other two good moments, skipping to the third one, is when her and Chris are talking about whether or not Lara Jean and Peter have had sex. She does this hand motion that, like, I can't describe on the podcast that is so funny. And then she says, we burn low and slow. We're like brisket. And, like, the delivery is just like, perfect, like master class. And then there's another quick moment where Katie's knocking on the door. I think it's after her and Peter have broken up, so she's like in low spirits and Chris is in the room with her and she says, Lara Jean's not here, leave a message, beep. Like, she is so, so great.
Funny. And
anybody who says that like they could have done this movie without her is absolutely kidding themselves.
No.
Like, we've talked a lot about iconic roles and like, you know, would they ever do a reboot? Much like, you know, Reese Witherspoon epitomizes, you know, the Legally Blonde character.
Elle Woods. Yeah.
Elle Woods. Lana Condor is Lara Jean. Like, they can never redo that. And actually, let's end here. Here's my question. Would you rather see a Lara Jean The College Years show series or wait 10 years, get a fourth movie?
I want to wait 10 years and get a movie with them together. Yeah, I want like a full, like, we're young adults in our 20s trying to make it in New York now together movie.
What would be like the main thing? Because I feel like that's why a series is so good, because it's like hijinks at the publishing house or like her interning or like trying to be a writer. And like,
it can be a series. I would take them as a series. And again, I think timeline wise, it couldn't be 10 years. It probably would have to be 5. But that time in your 20s is just as angsty. So I'm totally down for it. I want them to have their separate college experiences and then come back together. I don't know. I think my friends just have the perfect model and they should just do that.
All right. Two important lessons, everybody. If you're on your way to college and about to go off to different schools with your high school sweetheart, just take into consideration that there are other routes. And number two, please use proper face mask etiquette or Stephanie Kim will come and find you.
Mm-hmm. I will find you.
There we go.
Oh, by the way, this is our season finale. Yay! Love you. Bye. Oh, wait. No, I forgot. Follow us at RepeakPod on Instagram and Twitter. If you've made it this far, please leave us a review. We very much appreciate 5 stars. It really helps us out, guys. So if you have the time, please consider doing it. Do it. And we'll be back next season. Love you.
Bye. P.S. We just wanted to mention some additional acknowledgements that we'd be remiss if we did not include. First off, special shout out and thank you so much to Asian American Girl Club. They hosted an early screening of To All the Boys, Always and Forever that we were lucky enough to be part of. To Ali Maki, thank you so much for creating this community and growing it to what it is today. Second, you may not have heard that there has been a devastating rise of anti-Asian violence recently. It's been reported that 1 in every 4 Asian Americans has experienced anti-Asian hate during the pandemic. Since COVID-19, there has been a 1,900% increase in hate crimes against Asians in the U.S. In particular, the recent incidents involve assault, robbery, and violence of Asian and Asian American senior citizens, most occurring in broad daylight. To All the Boys has been so meaningful to those of us in the Asian American community as a wonderful example of representation both on and off screen. It's a beautiful world in which being Asian is part of our identity without it necessarily being a defining factor of who we are. And yet, there is clearly so much work to be done in this area. To learn more, follow at Asian American Girl Club and at Next Shark on Instagram to educate yourself on the issues as well as resources for how you can help. Thank you so much for listening. You make us feel special and know that you're special too. We love you. Happy Valentine's Day and Happy Lunar New Year.